Bishop of Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shap Talk Show. I'm every Dev Rupert. With me is Chris Piccadilly. Gordon, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. I'm thinking about spinning up about 15 side projects this weekend at a minimum.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, just kind of putting them out there. Newsletter. That's good.
I'm going to indie web.
Chris, who do we have in the studio today? are they writing their own microblogging service as we speak? Go ahead.
Yes, we have a special guest for you all, a longtime friend of the show, but who's never been on the show. Mr. Hank Chiseljaw himself, which I actually have no idea where that nickname came from. It's Andy Bell. Hey, Andy.
Hey, pals. Do you ever get the feeling you're being made fun of?
Yeah. No.
Oh, come on.
Just jealous.
Yeah, you've disturbed me. I've been rewriting my entire blog while you've been introducing the show.
Yeah, it's pretty tempting, isn't there? There's so much fun technology out there. I was perhaps poking fun a little bit, but I'm very sure that I don't know anybody with quite as many side projects as you have. And I don't even know if they're side projects usually, because they're usually so well done and pretty well put together that it's not like something you dabble around with. You're very open about just be like, I'm going to do a thing. I'm going to buy a URL for it. I'm going to throw up a landing page. I'm going to get a Twitter account for it, and then they come to life and they happen. And so there's all kinds of those, like the one Dave kind of made my name is I can't even say it. Piccadilly? How do you say it?
Piccadilly. Yeah. It's one word. Yeah. It's the one word I learned how to spell last year because I wrote it so often. I never knew how to spell it before, but now, like, you look, if you want me to write Piccadilly down on a piece of paper, I'm there. You know, I can.
You got it.
Yeah,
it's just a newsletter, but it's specifically about CSS stuff, which you'd think that there'd be loads of them, but there kind of isn't really. So it's nice. It's good. It's a good one. So thanks for doing that. Pick a lil, and then the last li in the word pick a lily is like the TLD, so the domain name. So feel free to check that out. And that's just one of kind of many things that you do. I'm sure we'll touch on a lot of the side projects you do. But how about just a quick introduction of yourself and how you think about yourself in the world for our listeners?
Oh, pressure. For real money, on a normal day, I'm a freelance web designer. But as you said, like, I tend to do a lot of other things, some of it is like for money and like the real products, like you say, and also things, education or whatever. But then some of them are just for me because I do such like massive stuff, quite similar to like what Dave does with Paravel, like huge projects, clients. Like, I don't get to have much fun anymore. So that's the main reason why I do my little side projects, is to say, oh yeah, I want to play with this little thing for a bit, and I get to do it in the sort of low risk environment rather than, you know, trying it out on a client project, which is never a good idea. But yeah, I suppose that's me really. I'm from like England as well. So yeah.
That's a common reason for any side project. I feel like side projects are talked a lot about in kind of like that meta dev culture of talking about ourselves and our lives and what we do, and that they keep you fresh on technology and keep you not bored and get you a chance to use technology that you wouldn't use in any other way. And for some people, that's like, you know, Svelte and stuff. And not that you have no interest in Svelte. I bet you probably do, at least to some degree. But a lot of what you do is focused a lot on like indie web, Jamstack, pre-rendered sites. You know, I feel like not that I'm trying to pigeonhole you or anything, but that's kind of like you're into
that
pretty
accurate
spirit of things. Yeah.
Jamstack is like really heavily on my radar. It has been for quite a long time. I think there's a low-level competition between me and Phil Hawksworth of who's got the most 1120 sites in the back pocket. I think Phil probably does, because I reckon he's got about 20,000 of all the little things he does for his day job. But I'm really not far behind him, I don't think. I'm definitely a 1120 super fan, to say the least. But yeah, it's real good.
Sure. So if people, that's Zach Leatherman's project. I think he's, mm-hmm. I'm sure he has contributors, but he's the main dev on it. He's been on the show before. It's really been, I feel like it's still early days for 11D potentially. Like, it's a pretty mature product in what it does, but like just yesterday I saw Jason Langsdorf and Zach get together and do one of those learning with Jason. It's like an hour and a half video where they sat together and Zach taught Jason how 11D works. And it was very satisfying, particularly because Jason previously came from Gatsby and he's just a pretty good dev in general and he drives the ship. So it's like, it's Zach kind of telling Jason what to type, but Jason's very like quick on the keyboard and has a nice dev setup, so he's easy to follow along with. And it was fun. I think Jason was very satisfied with what 11D is doing. It's kind of amazing how both simple it is and yet like it does stuff that is just like, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's how it works. It's that obvious. Oh, nice. You know?
Yeah, for sure.
But not a lot of people know that.
No, really? And that's it. And I think I touched on this. I did the post for you, didn't I, on your blog. And last year, 11T, projects that do 11T span from crappy little prototypes to full client projects. We released a book with it, all these things. It's because it's so simple and so well put together, it's incredibly easy to make really good stuff that's really powerful. It's got a really nice dev experience. And yeah, I'm just, there's not many things you can't do with 11T these days, I don't think, especially with the cool stuff.
If you compared it to Jekyll, Jekyll's probably got 1,000 times more people using it because it's just whatever, it came from GitHub. It's this OG static site generator kind of thing. And that's fine. Nothing against Jekyll. Dave's blog is currently on Jekyll, although he threatens every single day to rewrite it in 11D. Dave?
No, thanks to y'all. I don't need more work. I got to work on the Shop Talk site, but I like Jekyll. I love Jekyll. I use it, but once you're kind of told it's kind of slow, and that's sort of the fault with Ruby. It is getting better. Jekyll 4 is great. Ruby 3 will be great. There's a lot of speed buffs and
yeah. Isn't this the classic trajectory though? We're kind of trying to fix it, but honestly, there's just better stuff now. So you just use the better stuff.
Well, and that's the deal. Yeah. And so, but the grass is always green, right? It's that Monty Hall rewrite problem. But having used 11D on a few things with client work and side project work, I definitely see the oh, okay. This would do the same thing, similar API, pretty much the same. And I can just use JavaScript to write my own plugins and filters and extensions and stuff like that. And it'll compile in a tenth of the time. This is kind of a no-brainer.
Zach's the perfect guy to run it too, because if I had a project like that and it started to get some traction, I'd be like, oh, sorry, it's $100 now. It's $100. Sorry.
Yeah, ditto. Absolutely ditto. Yeah.
But Zach will never do that.
He wouldn't allow me to pull the switch on charging people for it. Yeah. But that's part funny. Of the appeal with it is that Zach's just such a good person as well. And it's been built well because Zach's got such a good reputation. So that was the biggest appeal for me, really, for it. I mean, my testimonial on 11T is Jekyll is dead to me now. Because I used to be really into Jekyll, and a side project which I wanted to start a few years ago was a blog called Things to Do While You Wait for Jekyll to Compile, because there's a few sites that I was
was
running.
Was it going to be a Jekyll site?
Yeah, rebuild your entire site in any other platform whatsoever other than Jekyll. But in all seriousness, I actually really got into Jekyll because I worked in an agency and it wasn't the best shop in the world, and they weren't the best at managing clients. So a lot of the projects were fluid, to say the least. So Jekyll was just great for that because you can really go to town on it, and everything can change, and you can really quickly respond to it. So I wish 11T was around in those days because it'd have been even quicker. But still, bless it, it's not very quick.
There's also stuff that isn't Jekyll's fault. Ruby is still kind of hard to install on a system. And I work with a lot of designers and getting them like, okay, go, you know, copy this thing, paste it in your command line. That'll install brew. And then you brew install RBENV. And then you brew install. And like for most of the people like I work with and in clients, not just my coworkers, Trent and Reagan, but like most of the people I work with, like, hi, I've wasted your whole week like installing Ruby. Like, and it barely works, you know, or falls apart.
Yeah, and I hope you didn't have any other Ruby things installed, because even though we installed RBM to try to, you know, stop that problem, it probably broke something else. And you probably need NVM too, because that's nothing's just Ruby anymore. So as much as we like to dunk on NPM, at least it just works usually, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the core problem with NPM is like, you know, and I had this yesterday, it can't install, maximum call size is exceeded. And you're like,
what?
Why?
Oh, I've never seen that.
And then you're like, oh, you just delete the node folder and then you reinstall. It was from like a private NPM, but it's like you reinstall, like, and then it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I can do it. So the only difference is you just had to delete the node folder, modules folder, and suddenly that solves it. So, like, I think that's going to be...
That's a classic joke, but it's so true. Like, it's incredible how many things every week of my life that's been an answer that I've seen work for somebody.
If I pick a project that I haven't worked on for a while that's got node modules folder, the first thing I do is delete it and then start again. Yeah, because it's just the amount of hours wasted.
It's like a feeling in your stomach, isn't it? You can look at a folder and just smell it and be like, no, that's old. Yeah, it's gotta go. Just dump it like old milk, you know?
Yeah, totally. I saw somebody was like, I archived 3 projects and deleted node modules and saved 8 gigs. Got 8 gigs back.
Yeah. I was reading blog posts about, because there's all these, you know, like Dropbox and stuff. You keep some stuff in Dropbox. That's the last thing you want to keep in your Dropbox is any node modules folder. But there's other things that back up too. Like Apple's got its own little backup iCloud-y stuff.
Time Machine.
People use Backblaze and that type of stuff. Like keeping any node modules out of all of that is a darn fine idea for your network.
Yeah, I'm considering a whole like hard drive. Like I have a big dumb Windows PC, obviously, but like a whole hard drive just for development, you know, and that's like, and everything goes on there. And that's my development thing. It never goes to Dropbox, never goes to OneCloud or whatever OneDrive. And so
I used to do a lot of video stuff, and we used to do exactly the same thing. You'd have separate drives for all that stuff. So it makes sense to do it with development as well, you know, because we're using that much IO these days to, you know, like I say, 8 gigs worth of node modules just so you can write hello world in React or whatever, then, you know, it's getting pretty wild in there. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's beefy boys.
Beefy boys. Thick boys, yeah.
Thick boys.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Jetpack. That's jetpack.com. Jetpack is a plugin for your self-hosted WordPress site that, in a sense, connects it to WordPress.com and thus gives it all kinds of powers. And in fact, in the past, I've kind of described it as like a kitchen sink of new superpowers for your website, including just really classically, obviously great stuff from a front-end development perspective, like having your images CDN hosted and lazy loaded. Just flip a switch and it's on and you're doing that. So all kinds of great stuff. I won't do the whole feature list here because it's just too much to cover in a small ad, but there's a change this year in Jetpack that is worth getting excited about. If you hear me say, oh, it's a whole kitchen sink full of stuff, and you're like, gross, I don't want a whole kitchen sink. Well, fine. Like, I might argue against that a little bit because you just turn on what you want and leave off the other stuff, but whatever. You might feel like you're like paying for too much or something if you decide to opt for a paid plan on it. You can now a la carte perhaps one of the best features on Jetpack, which is the backups. So if you don't want anything else in Jetpack except for the backups, which is the best possible way to back up your site, it backs up your theme and like all the files of your entire site and the media, all the images you've uploaded and all this stuff, and the database. So like it is your whole site, all the backup stuff, super well done. And in fact, if you go all the way, you know, pro up all the way, it'll back up in real time. So it's not like yesterday's backup. It's like last minute's update, which is awesome. And it helps you roll back to that moment. So if there's any problems at all with your site, you can just be like, boop, I want to roll back to that point in time and deal with that. So if that's all you care about, that's what you really need and want for your site, you got it with Jetpack, and you can a la carte it. You don't have to like opt in for the kitchen sink plan if you want. So that's that, Jetpack.
So you have a lot of side projects. Should we just do like a run through of each one and you give us a synopsis of what it is?
Well, we can do it slowly. Let's stretch it out. You know, I think I don't remember when I first met Andy, but I was, you know, he's guest written, thank you very much, on CSS Tricks a number of times. At one point we, you know, I posted something like, wouldn't it be nice? You know, there's like HTML5 boilerplate and there's these kind of boilerplates for certain things. It seemed to make sense to me that forms could be one of those things because it's so, forms are so similar in so many ways. Like you need a nice label input pairing and there's all kinds of attributes on them that need to go together. And there's so many things that we end up changing. Like just, you can't leave default on forms because of cross browser problems and the fact that they just look like crap natively. So wouldn't there be some, and then there's projects that exist. Sorry for like the way too long a backstory on this one, but there's projects like WTF forms from Mark Otto of Bootstrap fame. That's really well done. Like Mark did a great job of little snippets of CSS that kind of reset and apply basic styling to forms, but it's the repo is a little old and it's set up as just like, here's a snippet of CSS that resets like a file input or something. It's not like here's that and some HTML that you're supposed to use with it. And like, it should be set up as a kind of a nicer project like HTML5 boilerplate was. And Andy took it and ran with it. And this, I assume it's been a couple of years since you've touched it at this point, but it's called Boiler Form.
Oh yeah. That one was, so you caught me at a good time with that, because I remember reading that post, and like at that time, I wasn't that far from being like a product designer for a medical product, and as you can imagine, there was a lot of forms in that product, so I got really, really into forms, like any other cool person does, and so I got really, especially like saying to the attributes that make inputting content easier, and like email is a classic one. Like email, you can just set on the email field for it to not auto-capitalize, because why the hell would you want the first letter to capitalize on your email? But how many email fields have you filled in on your phone where the first letter is capitalized? And I know that's probably doesn't annoy people as much as it annoys me, because people are as weird as I am, but still, like, that's why I got into it. And so yeah, Boiler Form essentially was just a pattern library that I made, and it was like, look, just copy and paste this markup, and then if you want some CSS, then here you go. And it like fixed custom radio buttons, checkboxes, all that gubbins, and yeah, it was good fun. Good fun project that. And yeah, you're quite right, I've literally not touched it. In fact, I fixed the link on there, and it's a Jekyll site, and I just can't be bothered fixing it. Just won't build anymore, and I just can't be bothered fixing it. So there's just like a link that's forever broken on the site. So that's how that project's been left.
I was just talking about so there's some pens for boilerplate form left on the internet, which are a lot of times me is like, oh, I got to make a form. I don't wanna. There's so many. I hate attributes. No, I love attributes, but you know, I want to just like copy and paste something that's pretty ready to go already, and then I can adjust it from there. And that exists and is fine. And I use Boiler Form all the time for that. Like, just give me a big, it's like a saved snippet almost, because I'm too lazy to actually have a snippet library. I'm sure a lot of you out there have like a fancy one that you've saved into VS Code or use some third party software or something. I don't have any snippets, none. I handwrite everything. If I need to find something, I often just go look for a previous example in a project, or, you know, use my own website or things like this. And if I need a form, this is kind of what I come to. It's just kind of nice. This is how I would code a form anyway. So it's like a saved snippet for me.
I mean, I use it in the same way. Like it enabled me to sort of remove some stuff out of my memory and just have a reference for myself, because I'm really lazy developer. Like I hate writing code. I want to just copy and paste it from another project and tweak it. That's so that's another reason why I make these side projects, is so like when I actually do paid work, I don't actually write any code. I spend more time thinking then rather than actually writing characters on my text editor. Yeah.
So that was, I don't know, 2017, 18-ish, you know, not that long ago, really, in the grand scheme of things. Maybe shortly after that, you had some, you know, what seems like a passing now interest in web components. So that project still exists, webcomponents.club. We talk about them regularly on this show, often in mixed feelings kind of terms, because it's like really cool. Everybody's always roller coastering on how they feel about them or what their future is and stuff like that. At a moment, you must have been pretty hot on them because somebody, you know, you don't start webcomponents.club if you hate the idea, right?
That's it. So, like, at that time, like, I got, I watched a talk by Monica, I'm not going to try and say her name, sorry, Monica, Dina Klescu. Yeah, and it was on, and I remember it really vividly. She was one of the Google events, and like absolutely blew my mind. They'd done some really cool stuff. It was like the Lit team. And then, so I was like, right, I'm going to really take these seriously now, and I'm going to get into them. And I do like fundamentally think that web components are great, like, but they're really great as really low level primitives, which it's taken me a long time to sort of get it in my head where you can't replace React or Vue with web components. Like, web components do like the lowest fidelity job for you, and if you look at them like that, then they become really useful. And like, so like the thing I think web components are probably the most useful for are design systems, because that web component is totally technology agnostic. So you could use it in a Vue app, and you could use it in a Svelte app, and you could probably try and use it in a React app, but I know there's some problems like the events and stuff. But that's how I see them being the most useful, is being like really sort of small primitives that just do like one job and one job only.
I think there's plenty of people out there that agree with you on that too, that they're like, this is good stuff for design systems. Yeah. And I can picture it in like a card component. Great. Call the card and it comes with some basic, you know, composable styling for a card and it matches what we said. Button, same way, looks good, all kinds of stuff. But I lose it a little bit with something like a form or a dropdown, because like if you're going to write that in Vue, you have to like, I don't know, there's all this like the way that Vue handles events and the way that Vue wants you to do state with Vue X and stuff is not how you would write it as a web component. As a web component, you're just raw dealing with the DOM. I just don't see how they fit together, but they probably do.
I asked on Twitter about this, and everyone said, we use Redux or whatever. Like,
yeah.
And so I guess I mean, I don't know what that shim looks like or whatever. If there's,
do you like write a hook into your web component that says like unchanged, this is a select menu, and when it changed, then you provide your own hook. So if it's Redux, then you write your own little function that changes something in Redux. I just don't quite get it. Yeah, it seems like too much glue to be useful.
I think a good way of like working with web components is like utilizing events, because like in custom events, because you can really do some stuff with events if you take them seriously, and like maybe like a little pub sub pattern somewhere. And yeah, but you're right. I mean, I haven't used web components for like proper client stuff. I've used them like for like to do one little thing on a project maybe. But you know, if I picked up a juicy old JavaScript project now, I wouldn't go, right, I'm going to do it in vanilla JavaScript and web components, because they're just not quite there yet. And but I think we should, as a community, have some more faith in them. They will come and they will get good. I just think it's just going to be a slow movement. You touched on it in the last episode, or the first one this year, where we were talking about main element, you know, and it's just a spicy div, but it took 10 years to come out and be ready. And I think we're in for a long old game with web components as well. But I think as time sort of progresses, you know, they'll become more useful. And I think they should reach out the people behind web components and look at how React are doing things and how Vue are doing things, especially, and really sort of learn from that and try and pull that into the spec, I think. But, you know, that's just my opinion. And I certainly won't go on Twitter and say that because, you know, it happens then. So, yeah, give them time.
Yeah, I mean, just on that, like, I know, like, Nicole Sullivan has been reaching out to framework authors and stuff, like working with the Facebook React team and, you know, trying to make React work a little bit better on the web platform. Just from, and I think the first, like, thing we can fix was like main thread scheduling or something. So we're going to get prioritization of main thread operations. So like, so yeah, I mean, I hope like web components is like, okay, yeah, let's go, let's incorporate, let's just put Vue in the browser. Cause that's really ultimately what I want. But you know, I wonder when and how that happens. So, and I don't know if they're gun shy because, you know, there's stuff like Safari still is dragging their feet. There's like one piece they just refuse to implement. So
and that's then, the thing, isn't it? And then there's the HTML imports thing that I know both you and I, Dave, are incredibly and forever angry about, which, you know, that browsers can just pull the rug under it and ruin the
why
party.
Would you want to build a website with HTML only?
I know. Imagine that. Especially now in the Jamstack phase that we're in, you know, imagine how useful they would have been. But yeah, no, let's, you know, screw it. Let's just use JavaScript. But, you know, and he couldn't understand with these things and like the slowness with certain things like container queries and stuff like that, why people just go and like throw tons of JavaScript and stuff, because you run Babel and then it works everywhere, you know, and you run post CSS and your CSS runs everywhere. So like, why wouldn't you? So I can totally appreciate that. I think that's something I've sort of matured a bit with over the last 12 months. It's like, yeah, I get why people are doing it. They want to do things that the browser's just not letting them do at the moment. So I just totally understand why they're doing it. And I sort of like why I've started getting a bit more into React again and sort of approaching that with a warmer attitude than I have done previously, and Gatsby and stuff like that, because you can just sort of understand it a little bit more when you think about it from other people's perspectives.
That was on my list of things to ask you about. You have been talking about, you've been playing with Gatsby and stuff like that, and that seemed like a little, how should I say, off brand for you.
Yeah, I know.
So what, I guess, what was the change in attitude? What was sort of the...
So to give you a lot of context.
Oh, I think I'm going to pick it up.
Well, yeah, like, I mean, so my first touch with Gatsby was the start of last year. And I was working on a very, very big project that was using it. And it was using Contentful. And it was fine. You know, I'd done plenty of stuff with Next in the past, so it was like, it felt like a very similar experience to that. But it, at the time, it choked up quite a lot, and we just didn't need it to be choking up at the time. You know, we were working on like one of the craziest deadlines I've ever been on a project. You know, it was full on, very full on. And it was just, so I think I just got a very bad taste in my mouth. And and obviously it's one of the side projects that I run, is I'm really not a fan of Facebook. Like, I've got feelings about Facebook and opinions about Facebook. And so I always sort of, I've always associated React with Facebook, rightly so, and tried to remind people of that as well. But it ain't going away, is it? React is not going away. And it seems to be getting increasingly popular rather than decreasing. And it's been around since, was it 2013? So it's had a very good run so far. So I just sort of thought, well, if I'm going to sit here and, because as you, like, people that know me and follow me, like, my thing is like progressive enhancement, accessibility, and using the platform and being doing things as responsibly as possible. But if I'm yelling at you saying, don't use React because that's not the way to do it, then you're just going to stop listening. So what I thought is, well, why don't I actually try and help people write React better for the browser and do stuff like that. So try and drive the bundle size down and try and work out how to do progressive enhancement with React instead of just disregarding it. And because these things you get for, a lot of it you get for free with Vue, because Vue sort of, you can sprinkle it on existing code, but React is all or nothing. So trying to get into that mindset of the way I like to do things and I think we should be building things is difficult with React. So I thought, well, I'll just do it and maybe that'll be more helpful for some people in the industry. We'll see how it goes. But I mean, I've been playing with Gatsby for a project and it's been just a completely different experience to what it was the first time I worked with it. So hats off to them. You know,
it's interesting to think about how like your time crunch affects your perspective of a technology.
I mean, you can understand it though.
I'm trying to think if I have any.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I've had any experiences like that in the past as well. Just like, you know, I don't like this because I was told I needed to do it in 2 weeks or something. So,
I mean, that project was crazy and it definitely it's happened to me a few times over the years with certain technologies where they just haven't been helpful when the pressure's really on and you just think, I'm not going to use that again because in my opinion, it's rubbish because it was rubbish for you while you were using it. But yeah, I mean, I should have probably given it more of a chance, but then 11T is just really, it's done the job for me really efficiently. So I've not had the need for it, but you know, Gatsby has just exploded in popularity over the last 12 months, especially. So there's a lot of people out there using it. And I see a lot of things with Gatsby sites that I think, man, if you just did it like this, things would be a lot better. And I know they've got some great people there. They've got like Marcy there doing the learning stuff. So like they've got a really good team of people in there doing this stuff. So I think things are only going to get better in the future for it. So I think it's about time I was a bit more positive about it as well and go against my own brand of being a curmudgeon, you know.
I have been accused of that as well. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go full galaxy brain here. What if people don't like jQuery because it made it so easy to write that then people wrote a lot of jQuery and then their experience with jQuery is you have to fix this in 2 weeks or whatever, and they hate jQuery because it was hard to fix, but it's not because it was hard to fix. It's because somebody... it was too easy to write. Oh my God, what? That's my...
The thing is, I hated jQuery when I first used it. Because I was in an agency. And when I started in the industry, I was actually a proper designer, you know, like just static comps. And then I got into like coding because I used to hand over my comps and then I'd get back a link to a website and it's like, did you even look at the PSD that I sent you? So I was like, I'm just going to learn CSS myself because I want them to look good. And then I got into like the Flash world. So I was real pissed off at Steve Jobs for, you know, essentially killing Flash off. And so they were like, oh, you want to learn jQuery instead. And it just, after writing ActionScript, jQuery just felt ridiculous, you know. But then now I love it. So yeah, I think the conclusion here has been nice. Yeah, you're there, yeah.
Can hear you now.
It's cool to just hear your attitude on it all, you know. Like I can see things have a way of kind of roller coastering with technology and people and the way things people feel about things and all that, you know. I think we're all kind of rooting for web components in a way. I mean, if they don't solve our problems now, that's unfortunate, but they, what's obviously, maybe just to put a point on it, they're built into browsers, so they have the potential to be super fast. You need to load no libraries. You'd need to necessarily run no build process. I mean, that's incredible. So there's those of us that really care about those things are like rooting for that ability to take place. But then you look at like, okay, a handful of people are using them, and then this ocean of people over here using React and other JavaScript libraries. Obviously, there's something going on there, and that's not ignorable as well. So you can kind of have a foot in both worlds, I think, kind of successfully.
I think that's quite useful as well. Yeah.
Yeah, just today on the DQ blog, the DQ are the makers of...
Dairy Queen?
Oh, no. Is my microphone just dead, Zo?
No, DQ blog.
Oh, gosh. I thought it was... DQ, like the dilly bar, you know? Like they tip the... DEQUE.
Oh, yes.
All right. We're in. All right. Okay. Go on, Chris. Sorry. Carry on. We'll stop messing around.
I would subscribe to both of those blogs for the record. Axe, and they have the extension. I think they've even sponsored the show in the past when they came out with the like Axe Pro plugin thing, which is actually pretty cool. It's like for teams and accessibility. They obviously know what they're talking about with accessibility. Major player in this world. Mm-hmm. I just read, just because I subscribed to their blog today, Debunking the Myth, Accessibility and React. So they're saying, or having their employees say, that like it's not React that's the problem. It's you using it in a way. There's actually all kinds of powerful stuff that you can do with React to actually help with accessibility and make it less of a big deal because React is doing it for you in a way. I've had that experience myself in using, you know, certain plugins that are like ready to go with accessibility that are, that do a better job than I probably would have, even as an accessibility-minded, raw HTML kind of guy. These plugins did it better. So I've always kind of, but then there's, you know, reports out there that like look at sites in aggregate and say, you know, we know these sites are using React and these sites are some of the worst for accessibility. So you can't exactly argue with the data either. You know, like if it's a, there's obviously something wrong with the
frame. Yeah, that's something I've been, I literally yesterday thought about this. I was building something and with React, and so there was quite a bit of like accessibility stuff in there, certain things like live region bits and like alert role here and there. And I think it's actually easier to implement this stuff with like a state-driven reactive framework because you can just bung it into the HTML at the point of authoring. And I think you're thinking about it at the right time, or the JSX or whatever, but you're thinking about it at the right time and you just, you know, like in Vue and React, if you just set an attribute and if its value is null when it gets rendered, then it won't render the attributes. That's really, really useful because you can put little ternary statements here and there. And I think it's a lot easier to do that than with like vanilla JavaScript. So I think if there's some good education out there and there's some good tools to help people and good material, then and just the mindset change where people focus more on accessibility as like a priority, then yeah, I think React could quite quickly lose that sort of reputation that it's got over the years of being like anti-accessibility. Because you're right, it's not the framework, it's just the people that have been writing it. And I think early documentation didn't help because people used to put like click events on divs in the documentation, which obviously people are just going to copy and paste that code straight into the, especially in the learning, so yeah, get that started.
Yeah, I was, there was a good post on the 24 accessibility calendar, advent calendar, about selects, or like imitating the native select. And I forget who, I'm blanking, Sarah Higley, I think who wrote it. So she, you know, looking at like a select, and she's like, it's basically impossible to replicate what a select does, especially cross browser, because Mac does one thing and Windows does another thing. So good luck with yourself. And then, but she tries out, like a couple other like options where like, you know, you have like an autocomplete and it creates a little like whatever chip or tag or whatever. And then tested it with real users. And it was a phenomenal post. I mean, that's really not React specific, but it's just like an example of how if you stray from the native elements, you actually provide a worse experience, especially with the select element. But if you're doing a select multiple, well, select multiple actually sucks for like 25% success rate, the worst performing of all the solutions. So like you're better off with like a JavaScript driven solution, and you know, with state and everything, React is probably a really great candidate for that. But yeah, anyway, it's very interesting, and there's a very like fine line. Cause if you choose a framework like React, it's probably cause you're doing these pretty intense, like state driven UIs. But then like, for me, it's like, you have to have the confidence, even with Vue or anything other, insert framework of choice here, but you once you start taking control of all that, you really have to like, you have to be the owner of the accessible experience. And that's a lot of work. That's a lot of responsibility.
When we've talked with accessibility people on the show, there is some classics to accessibility problems that are so simple, you know, that maybe even the bulk of accessibility work is the stuff that you're sick of hearing about if you're probably a listener to the show or a reader of, you know, general front-end development news. But like, put alt tags on your images, use header elements, don't put onclicks on divs, use a button instead. These things that are largely, even I mentioned DQ, but even that little Axe plugin, you just run it on the page and it'll tell you exactly what to do, because these are like just simple things, you know? So those simple things are a problem wherever you write them. You can miss an alt tag in a React site or a Vue site or an HTML site. It's irrelevant which framework you're using. It's an accessibility problem no matter what. So to look at that and be like, well, that site uses React and has that problem, that must be React. No, it's just somebody who didn't write an alt tag. It's just React got more popular. That's all.
You could achieve so much by just writing good quality HTML as well. Like, you can really achieve a lot by doing that. You know, obviously we've got ARIA, but, you know, what is it like? The first rule of ARIA is to not use ARIA or something like that. Which is, I think, maybe true, but I don't think so when you've got, like, something really dynamic. I think you've really got to dig in at that point. But, like, yeah, for, like, a blog or whatever, like, if you get your structured HTML going, then you're good to go. You know, you've done a good job, but, you know.
Even that is funny, isn't it? There's a great one on Smashing Magazine it was Bruce Lawson was digging into article versus section. It's kind of one of those classic ones so that nobody actually knows what they're doing with those tags. They're just like, I don't know, this feels
apart
good.
From Bruce.
Yeah. Bruce, actually. Yeah.
I volunteer as tribute.
So I read two articles back to back. They happened to be published the same day. One of them was on some other, you know, generic blog kind of thing, and one was on Smashing Magazine. And the, you know, the other one, I hate to like dunk on it, I won't even name them, but it was kind of a fluff piece. It was kind of just like, oh, you should use the section instead of div because section has accessibility benefits. You got to think of the screen reader users, so use section. But there was no like evidence or why or what happens when you do or what's the deal, you know? Because it's actually just not true. Like, just because you use a section happens to have a role of section or I put a foot in my mouth.
Yeah,
but it's not. Yeah. It's not a landmark unless you put an ARIA label on it, and then it's a landmark. And none of their code samples had that or talked about it in any way. So it's kind of, and then Leonie Watson chimes in the comments on Bruce's article where he talks about this. And The problem on their site was they have the summary at the top of the article, but it just goes from summary right into the article. So if you're a screen reader user, you don't understand that the thing at the top was the summary. So he's like, I'll put a section around it. And the solution was to put a section around it with an ARIA label on it called summary so that it made sense when you're leaving the summary and going into the rest of the article that there was a landmark that explained what was going on. But, you know, Leonie Watson links up the stuff. He's like, yeah, you can do that. You can name the thing, but 2.6% of actual screen reader users even care about that landmark at all. And chances are everybody navigates with like 70% or something based on the headers within it. So it's kind of like, sure, it's kind of for screen reader users. It's for 2.6% of screen reader users, you know, like, my gosh. And that's the only thing a section does. So it's kind of like, what a useless tag, you know.
Now you want a ghost heading somewhere on the page that is labeled.
Probably. And not to mention all the misinformation out there of people saying like, oh, it's a section tag. That means your H1, you know, headers start over within the action. Because there was blog posts about that when it was being talked about, but it never happened.
Nope. Yeah, it's literally Bruce Lawson's blog.
Just read Bruce's blog backwards and then you get the right order of things. HTML Doctor, Jim. Well, that was a classic one, HTML Doctor.
It causes the problems and then solves them.
Cheers, Bruce. Yeah.
He's the web's alcohol.
I think.
No, he's really great.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Netlify. That's netlify.com. Feels like everybody I know has got something on Netlify these days. It's just kind of taken over developer consciousness in this world. It's great because it's not for absolutely everything, but it kind of almost is, especially if you open your mind and think of re-architecting and thinking how websites could be built. They're really doubled down in this idea of Jamstack, which I couldn't be more in support of. It's so great. I'm not even going to do the acronym for you because I bet you know it. If you don't, just Google Jamstack and it will take you to a page that explains all of like the philosophy of what it is. But light philosophy here, it's kind of about the static hosting. It's like, what if we could pre-render most of our site? And feel free to think static site generator if you want to, you know, like all the speed benefits and security benefits and like the fact that I can have it on a CDN and take advantage of all of that stuff. Isn't that great? Netlify helps a ton with that. It makes the developer tooling and integration around that super good, but then takes it a step further and says, hey, we know you can't pre-render everything. Why don't you pre-render what you can and then hit APIs for the rest of the data and do it that way? Fine, cool. And how are you going to hit those APIs? Well, you could hit them client side, or how about we help you with cloud functions? You know, the AWS Lambda stuff that's so powerful and inexpensive these days. It's a little finicky to get started with Lambda stuff, but it isn't on Netlify because you just put like node functions in a functions folder and they just run. You don't even have to have an AWS account. Netlify helps you with all that. It's incredible how they abstracted it away. So to me, it feels like, wow, I'm this front-end developer building sites in this very comfortable way that I know is really good for the web and these really powerful, resilient sites. But still, when I need back-end-like features, like I need to use a server, run some node code to do some stuff, talk to other services, hit my own APIs, process some code, who knows all what, that's available to me too. Even stuff like auth, even stuff like form processing, Git hooks. They have so much cool stuff in Netlify. I don't even know where to start and stop talking about them sometimes because there's so much to look at. But don't be overwhelmed by it. It's very simple to get started as well. In fact, you can just drag a dang, you know, the other day I was on CodePen, exported a pen to a zip file, unzipped the folder, grabbed the dist folder in there, dragged and drop it on Netlify because they have this cool drag and drop file, and it deployed a site to a domain, and the whole video was like 17 seconds, and I feel like I took my time. So it's also very super easy and fast to get started too. You know, take some files, get a URL in 17 seconds, let's say. Thanks for the support, Netlify. Well, let's move on a little bit. Or do you have...
Yeah, we have 20 more projects.
We've only done like two so far. We'll be here all week.
Well,
yeah.
We had Hayden on the show not long ago, and Hayden talked about all kinds of stuff that Hayden talks about, but he's your partner on crime on a particular project called Every Layout, which is a little cheeky to begin with, but I like it because it's, how many layouts are there really? Can you make columns? Can you make a grid? Can you set things side by side? That kind of stuff. And Every Layout is like a blog and book that gets into that stuff, and you can buy it. So that's a... something.
Hell yeah, you can, and yeah, you should. But it's a real cool project. That's my marketing spiel by it. But it was sort of like me and Hayden were both talking about the same stuff, really, but independently of each other. I think two examples was like he was doing the Holy Albatross thing, and I was doing one on like flow and rhythm and using like what we call a stack now in Every Layout. And so we were sort of both approaching CSS in the same way as each other, like sort of algorithmic and writing as little as possible. And then we sort of got chatting. Hayden had already like half started the project and he was like, do you want to get involved in this? And yeah, it is right up our street, both of us, and it's been unbelievably successful. Like, we didn't believe it would be as successful as it has been, and it's helped so many people just improve the front ends as well. So it's great. It's really good for the old morale as well, to know that, and we keep adding to it too. So it's not quite Every Layout yet, but maybe one day.
Was this one of your first ones you were like, let's turn on the money machine? Or I don't know the chronology here, but that seems to be one of the first ones you're like, I'm charging for a thing.
Yeah, we had the, because like me being me, like I've like desperately organized, like immediately created as a intense Notion Kanban, and the one card in there was Filthy Lucre, because like we really knew we wanted to charge money for it, because like in between the both of us, we've like worked on some like humongous stuff and done stuff for like big companies and big projects. And it's like there's a lot of experience going into these layouts, and we think it's about time that we actually charge for it as well. And I think that's something just I've been obsessed with recently. It's like, why is it so hard for people to make money on the internet? Like, why can't more people make more money on the internet? Because people work hard and they produce a lot of good stuff, and they should be making more money a lot easier. And so this sort of Every Layout project, like I built a an API for it that does all the charging and content delivery for it. And, you know, that sort of opened a few doors for me for some stuff that I'll release this year that will hopefully make it easier for people to make money on the web. But, yeah, so that's how it does. And we're really determined to self-publish it as well, because we wanted to make the most money possible. And we didn't think it'd actually do that well either. We didn't think it'd sell many copies, so we thought we'll try and like latch onto as many of the pennies as we could. But we were surprised by how many people took an interest in it, really. So yeah, it's good. And it's built with 11T as well, the whole thing, everything, even the premium content. It's all, the only thing that's different between when you've actually purchased it is it's got a little Express.js wrapper that just does a bit of magic that determines whether or not you can see the cool stuff. So yeah, it's great. The fact that, so like a 1.11T project, it creates the book for us that you get with it. It creates the websites and it does all the sort of heavy lifting for us. And all we have to do is just write content.
Oh, but it's not Jamstack because you had to throw a Node server in front of it?
Yeah.
That's funny. I wonder if you could have done it with JSON Web Tokens or something.
Well, that you, funny you share that, Chris, because that's how I did another thing. But I had this sort of determination at the time. I was like, I want the content to be just completely server rendered. So what all Express does, and it's a handy little trick this is for anyone else who's like interested in doing this stuff, is you can make Express serve a static directory, and so that's all it does. But what you can do for every single request that comes in, you can put some middleware. So in that middleware, I do the little checker to check that they've got a session and everything, and that's it. So really, mm-hmm. It is like a little Netlify box, but it's just got a little extra bit of glitter on there doing that stuff for me. But super low tech, and that's just the best way to have it. I spent a lot of time sort of thinking about how to deliver the content to people, because I wanted it to be as easy as possible for someone to actually read the content that they've purchased. And I'm so glad we got to where we got with it, because some of the crap we came up with, I'm so glad we didn't do. At one point we were talking about bundling into an Electron app, and it's just like, imagine if we'd have actually done that. Like,
a lot of technical, what an awful overhead
for people. But yeah, for sure. It's like, oh yeah, here's the 200 megabytes of application to read some text. You know, it just felt ridiculous. So I'm glad we got to where we did with it. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff coming for every layout this year as well. One of which is we're actually going to start doing some stuff with React and Vue and integrating the layouts with those frameworks, so people can actually just drop them straight into their projects. Because at the moment, they're just web components and they're not as useful as they could be for people. So we're going to try and do that, so people have got, like, when they buy the product, they can, you know, use it a lot more easily in their projects. So a lot of stuff to come. It's certainly not a dead project like most of my side projects. So.
Well, we've mentioned 11D a bunch of times. There's a starter kit you've built for that called Hylia, or I hope I got that right, Hylia.website.
I forgot about that one. Yeah.
It's like 11T, you know, the ways I've started with 11T in the past is just like reading the docs and like npm install 11T, which is kind of fine. But then you're like, okay, so I need a config file. I guess that, like, oh, where does it want me to put folders here? Okay. And then, you know, not that it's all that hard, but starting from scratch is harder than it is to just grab a project that's already kind of has some stuff ready to go. It probably is kind of blog-esque, so it's kind of ready to go for that. So you could get started insanely quickly with something like that. So check that out.
That was fun, that one. Yeah, I enjoyed that. And it's mainly just an empowerment tool. Yeah.
It made the rounds.
I think it's really cool and probably, like, I mean, beautiful design, we should say, but and has an RSS feed. Check. Nice. But the, I think, like, what is really cool is like your rollup config is really digestible. I mean, not to compare contrast too much, but like you compare this to like your standard Gatsby config, it is way different. And so, and even the config you give is mostly just for the admin section, for the Netlify admin stuff.
Yeah,
and so,
for sure. Yeah. I can't take credit for the rollup one though. That was Sean from Netlify did that. But yeah, go on. I'll take the credit for now, though. Go on. Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. He's the Netlify CMS guy, too. No wonder he was interested, because that comes...
Yeah, for sure. And he did all the sort of really fancy stuff for the CMS. Like, he did like the live preview stuff and all that. And yeah, it was really, really appreciated, because I just have a clue and then that stuff. So it was great to get that in there. Yeah.
But you have like a handful, like I guess it's 7 NPM scripts or whatever, like for building the site or serving or locally working and stuff like that. And, you know, I think that's really cool too, because, you know, Netlify, or sorry, 11D, I'm getting all these products confused. 11D, it comes and you, like you 11D serve and it just starts working. Mm-hmm. And you're like, dude, this is awesome. And then you're like, okay, I have 2 JavaScript files. Uh-oh, what do I do? Or like, or I want to use SAS. It's like, uh-oh, what, how, you know, I'm breaking down. I don't know how to do my job anymore. And so, like, whereas like Jekyll did all that for you, now 11D is kind of like purposefully agnostic. It seems like they're just like, we don't know what you use. So, bring your own. So I think it's your, but I use this Hylia scripts block quite a bit, or kind of customized to my own needs. But
oh, yeah, cool.
It was very helpful.
Oh, and that's good to hear. That's it. I think a few people have like just taken bits from it, and that's just great, because like that sort of project was like an amalgamation of all the suffering that I've done with various like projects with 11T over the years. Like no fault of like Zach or the project, but similar to what you were touching on there, Dave, where I was used to Jekyll just doing everything for me, and or WordPress projects or like CodeKit or whatever. So it was just like, I just want people to be able to even just one-click deploy to Netlify and be able to publish their own website and it be on Jamstack. And that was the main goal. It's like, I'm sick of seeing Medium links. I want people to be able to publish their own content and own it, and then, you know, and not have to be technical to do that as well. The project has enabled quite a few people like that to do the job. So I'm very happy with it. And I should probably do some work on it at some point. I've just sort of left it to die, bless it. But I will do some more bits to it eventually. And my site, my website is a Hylia site as well. So, you know, I'm really eating my own dog food big time with it. So it helped me out on that front.
That's kind of an interesting one, in that how does it digest it? Like, because your own website's customized now. So if you go work on your own website, you're just kind of working on your own website, right? You'd have to go back to some other project to port your changes.
Yeah, it's completely ejected now forever. It's on its own. So, so it'd be a manual thing. That's one thing I found really hard with that project. Is like, how do you make it easy for people to update it from the sort of the main project? And the only thing I sort of settled on was like, every time I do big changes, I do release notes and with a list of files that changed, because most people like customize it when they get it. No one really uses it and just tweaks like the design tokens or anything like that. They just go get into the SAS, and that's, you know, totally expected as well. And some of the sites I've seen built with it, you wouldn't even recognize it to be of that project until they say, oh yeah, by the way, I used Hylia to build it. And you're just like, what? You know, someone made one the other day that was just like mind-blowingly good with loads of 3JS stuff, and they're like, oh yeah, I use your starter kit. And I'm like, where? Like, I can't even see it anymore. It's not even, until I looked at the markup and I was like, oh yeah, there it is, there's my silly square brackets. So it's just great to see it empowering people to build stuff and own it themselves, which is, you know, it's just great. And then, like you said, Dave, they get an RSS.
So what's
feed.
Unique is they'll never, if you built a site out of it, you'll never pull down a new version of Hylia. But because you just can't, it's like too weird. But it's kind of like, who cares, right? It's so simple that like, it's not like there's going to be some major security breach with some static files.
You know? Let's hope not. Yeah, don't jinx it, Chris. Yeah. it's essentially, it is like it's a starter kit, and I think if you look at it as a starter kit, then you know you don't expect to get a starter kit to be sort of dynamically updating itself in the background. Do you? It's like a install once and run with it job. But yeah, it's cool. It's a fun project. And this every layout did enable that, because it did better than we thought it would do. It enabled me and Hayden to sort of like take the foot off the gas a little bit last year and work on stuff that interested us more. And that was something I had on my like list of projects I want to do as like a proper good start kit for 11T. So I'm glad I got to do it.
I guess this kind of gets into the question I want to ask. I mean, just I want to ask you, and I'm sure people who like have listened to the show and heard about your 200 side projects, like how do you manage it all with like work and bills and family and kids? And maybe the second question to that is, how do you pick which one to work on? Like after the kids go to bed, how do you even decide? Like, so like, how do you manage it to even do it as a lifestyle? And then how do you pick one to work on?
So like the answer to the first question is I'm freelance. So I have ultimate control over my own time. And even before I was back freelancing, when I was working for companies, like I did a lot of years of remote working anyway, which is just saves you so much time in general versus like commuting to an office. But like the other thing is just like I'm one of those annoying people that's like desperately organized. Like everything is done to like the minute for me, and I use Notion obsessively. Like I've got bullet journals, so I tend to not write a line of code until I've planned it to within an inch of its life, so which I think helps me churn stuff out really quick, because I've done a lot of the thinking before I even open my text editor. So it's a case of like, right, I know what I'm doing now, I'm just gonna thrash it out. But to decide what I want to work on, I get bored really easily of projects. Like if you look, I've got a link on my site that's just like a list of them, and the 90% of those links are just like I haven't touched them for a long time. So it's like I tend to try and build stuff, so once it's built, it just works and it'll stay working for as long as possible. That tends to be how I like to do things. And then if I come back to it, great. And if I don't, then no biggie. You know, I'll learn some stuff from it. It might help someone out. Whatever. There's only a few projects that like really sort of grip me and keep me interested in them, and they tend to be the ones that make me money as well. So, you know, it's weird. That's obvious. But and when the kids go to bed, I just drink wine and watch TV. So, because I'm so tired, as you know, both being parents, there's not much brain going on after that happens. So. Yeah, I tend to write blog posts in those times. But yeah, that's it really. There's no real secret to it apart from me being like annoying and obsessively organized by everything.
I identify with that. Mm. I feel like I think for 2 days before I write a line of code now. And maybe that's really wasteful. But I just, it's like I want to know what I'm doing, or like I want to think through what I'm doing. Whereas I know other people are just like, what is it? Okay, cool. 600 lines of code in 1 hour. And it's like, okay, well,
I'd rather write 30 lines
on
of
NPM
code.
Or yeah, exactly. That's where I'm at. It's like, what's the 3-line version? So, but different people, different strokes, I guess.
I mentioned this last year. I like to put a tweet because I was thinking about it. Like, I've been doing this 10 years now, and I don't enjoy coding like I used to enjoy coding when I was like a junior. I think that's because, like, you have, when you're sort of learning, you have so many like pitfalls and you're constantly failing, and you have all these little wins all the time, aren't you? When you like you battle with for a few hours on something, but there comes a point where you don't have that anymore and you just write code. And I think at that point, writing code isn't that much fun anymore. And so I actually much prefer to sit and think about things and like think about how things could go wrong, like how it could be helpful for people, how could it be abused, how could it damage someone, rather than just writing the code. And I think like my output quality has got so much better since I've approached things like that as well. So yeah, I'm a big advocate for slowing down and simplifying things. You know, think about things until you simplify it and then start writing the code to go with it. So yeah, some food for thought.
There's a lot to that. Probably deserves a whole show someday.
Slowing down.
Let's end up with just to mention that's kind of how this show came about, is you have the latest side project is front-end-challenges.club. Front-end Challenges Club. So we probably don't have too much time to talk about it. So we'll just let people have your fun. Just go check it out. There'll be a link in the show notes, or just follow Andy. I'm sure he'll be talking lots about it. But the gist of it is sign up, and it's also a paid product. And Andy will challenge you with front end design stuff, but along with a community of people who are also doing it. So have some camaraderie and be challenged to up your front end game.
It's good fun, that one. I'm really enjoying it. Really enjoying it. Because I get to build things again as well, like fun little things that I just don't get to do anymore. And then, teach people how I do it in the real world. And, yeah, people are getting lots of value from it. Because they build it and then they're like, oh, wow, I didn't think about all these, weird little situations that you've raised in the solution post. So it's been good watching people, benefit from that as well, which is good. Very much enjoying it. And yeah, you can pay for it, and you should.
Wonderful. All right. Well, I guess, Andy, before we leave, how can people follow you and give you money?
So the best way to see me is on Twitter or my website. So it's twitter.com/HankChiseljob. We'll put a link in the show notes. I'm not going to explain how to spell it or why it's spelled like it is. And then the same, HankChiseljob.com. And then if you want to give me money, do it. I love money. Just buy a copy of every layout. I think I'll do a discount code. So do if you put shop talk in the coupon code, we'll do 50% off or something. And then, Front End Challenges Club, go on that and just join up. But it's great fun, and you can do it monthly as well. So you could bail out at any point. So yeah, it's good fun. Nice one.
Nice. Well, thank you. And thanks for in sharing all about your side project. It's pretty inspiring for me. Who I also like the side projects, but I make no money on them. So thank you. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star our favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
ChopTalkShow.com.